The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. Welcome to Polling Politics. I'm Joe Twyman from Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist and now author Marie LeConte.
This week is a special episode. There's simply so much going on and it's moving around so quickly it's impossible to come to any sort of conclusion. Anything we say will be out of date. So instead, I'm going to be joined by a special guest, Marie LeConte.
Hello. I like that you make it sound like this was very much a second choice of like, Jesus Christ, we have nothing else to talk about. Fine. We'll talk about your book, Marie.
Well, it's an interpretation. Marie is the author of Haven't You Heard? A book that is newly available from shops and Amazons and presumably soon garages and supermarkets. But before we start, a special announcement. Marie, we're going on the road.
Oh, God.
Yes. Many of you at home will have been listening to this thinking, I wonder what those two will be like in real life. Well, for those of you that haven't bumped into us drunk at the pub in the Westminster Arms, we are going to be at this year's Podcast Live event down in London. If you're interested in coming along and seeing a live recording of the show, it'll be Marie and I plus some high-quality guests, if we can get them booked. And the address for tickets is www.podcastlive.com. So you can go there Saturday, October the 5th. All the fun starts at 10 a.m. So please come along. There's a lot of other podcasts, obviously not as good as ours, on that day. So you can even buy day passes to cover the whole thing. It's going to be really, really different, but seriously a lot of fun. So please come along. We'd love to see you.
Hey.
So this week we're going to do things a bit differently. We don't have a guest. In fact, well, I have a guest, and it is author Marie LeConte. Hello, Marie.
Me?
Moi?
Little Marie?
Oui. That's right.
Hello,
Marie,
thanks for having me.
This week we're going to talk about your book. Now, ordinarily, the reviewer of a book would be sent a copy in advance with which to prepare. I can't help noticing that my copy, and so the same with Nick's, our copies haven't arrived. Are they lost in the post?
So would it help if I said yes? Like, would you prefer it if I said that the copies were lost in the post and not that I just entirely forgotten to send you copies?
Let's imagine then that I had received a copy. What would first attract my attention about your book?
Well, obviously, you're a huge fan of mine. So I think that, you know, that'd be the good first step for you.
The moment I saw MLC at the bottom, I'd be, yeah. Yes.
No, exactly. So I think, you know, that would be an important first step.
Is there a picture of you on the inside cover, that sort of thing?
No, I didn't want to because I'm very vain and I couldn't find a picture of myself I liked enough to do it. And also, I was really tempted because I thought, because my publishers offered to have a picture of me on the jacket, on the sort of like, inside cover. And I was like, the problem is if I say yes, the temptation to just do a really stupid picture is going to be very, very strong. And I'm not sure I'll be able to resist it. I don't trust myself to resist it.
When I write my book about the intricacies of polling methodology, I think I'm going to, but with loads of sex jokes put in, I think I'm going to have a picture of me with a chainsaw on the back. I think
nice.
That's the way to go. It might be on the front, actually. That might be the front cover.
I quite like that. Because see, like literally just in the time we've talked about this, my thought is now, God damn it, I should have done a recreation of the Sally Berko like naked picture with the House of Commons in the background, but dressed as a furry. So, see, don't trust myself.
I'm already aroused. So, I'm gonna have to take out this whole chair.
The massive like dog.
So,
oh my god! No, hang on. A recreation of the Sally Berko picture with the House of Commons in the background and like holding the sheet naked, but with the Alan Mack blanket.
All I can think about are the opportunities that have been missed now with this. But hopefully, with the reprint, with the subsequent editions, with the sequels, then these are simply one of, or two of a number of possible opportunities that we could explore.
Exactly. I mean, I will be hiring you to be my artistic director. I feel like there's a lot of sort of like creativity here.
I think we work together very well. So your book is looking at Westminster gossip. Where did the kernel for this idea come from?
Oh, so that's quite straightforward. Last April, one night I couldn't sleep. And I kept thinking, like, for a long time, I thought that I really wanted to write a book. So yeah, there's one night I couldn't sleep in April. And I was like, okay, how about I just think, you know, for now, like, I'm not going to do anything else because I can't sleep. I'm going to, you know, try and find a topic. And I was like, okay, let's maybe do this the other way around. What am I interested in? And I was like, okay, well, politics, that's a given. So it has to be a book about politics. And then, yes, obviously, furries.
Alan Mack,
and yeah, which is why my comic series will be coming out soon. But you know, someone knows that, like, oh, gossip. You know, gossip is what interests me. And then basically the next day I kind of Google around, because it's quite, which I thought was quite interesting. I was convinced that someone must have written a book about the role of gossip in politics already, because it felt to me like such an obvious topic. But yeah, so that's kind of how it came about. But I guess taking the kind of like longer, like the bigger picture, it was, so I kind of came in to Westminster through a slightly different route. I've never been, like, to this day in the lobby or anything. And I've not actually been a like, sort of like straight political news reporter for most of my career. But I kind of came in through the Evening Standard Diary. So I was at the Londoner's Diary desk and kind of there really organically found that I end up writing about politics a lot. So, you know, as my colleagues there would go to like a charity bingo night hosted by Kate Blanchett, you know, I'd be like, well, I was actually at the book launch of a backbencher last night. So who's winning here? But you know, so I kind of came into politics via the kind of the informal route, the gossip route, the kind of, you know, I never went to briefings or to press conferences. I was just going to parties and to the bars and everything, kind of meeting people that way. So I think my understanding of Westminster politics has always been colored by that kind of the importance of the informal.
What were the early days as a diarist for the Evening Standard like? How does it work as someone new to that role?
It's really fun because it's completely sink or swim. So Joy Lodico was the editor of the diary at that point, and we'd met through other stuff. And at some point, she was hiring for sort of like new freelancers on the diary desk. And really early on, she said, oh, you know, by the way, it's not a job for everyone. Don't be disheartened if you don't make it there. Like, you know, it's not you. It's just the desk is weird. But no, basically, so like my first day there, so I kind of went and did the shift. And then, because the shifts are quite short in the office, and then because we have to go to events in the evening. And she was like, right, so I am sending you to this book launch tonight at Dawn Books in Marylebone. Get a story. And I was like, what? And she was like, just, you know, go there and come back with a story tomorrow morning. I was like, oh, fine. And that basically refused to give me any other sort of like information as to how I was meant to get a story. She just like pushed me into that room, basically.
And was that the story about the diarist who streaked at a book launch?
You know what? And I think that's why I quite like diarists. I was quite well behaved by diary standards, which says a lot about other diarists. But yeah, no, so it's kind of completely, because I think everyone has a sort of different way of doing it. And the general idea is just you go to events and you talk to people and you just have to come out any room you walked into with a story. So that can be a funny quote from someone important. That can be like finding out some new bits of information, just anything. It's a great job.
And would you define that as always gossip, sometimes gossip, or something different?
So that was quite interesting. Like, that's one of my favourite bits in the book. So I interviewed quite a lot of lobby journalists, political editors, editors of newspapers for Haven't You Heard? And I asked them all, I said, OK, what's for you? What's gossip? What's news? Like, what's the difference between gossip and news?
Just stop you there. You also interviewed me. Did my interview make the final cut?
So you are quoted in at least two bits, I believe.
Then we may continue the interview.
Yeah. Fine, just put down the knife. It's all good. You know, and none of them gave me the same answer. And actually quite a lot of them were quite stumped and said, you know, I can't come up like for you with a definitive line, you know, on like what is gossip and what is news, because it depends on so much. It depends on, you know, the paper you work for. It depends on, you know, the kind of the way you got the story, I guess. It depends on, like, you know, so anything. So I think one person who was quite interesting was Jack Blanchard, because he was the...
Jack Blanchard from Politico, who writes their email.
Yes, so I was going to say...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've got our listeners in mind as well. But, you know, he was the political editor of The Mirror and then moved on to be the editor of Playbook at Politico. And he was kind of saying that actually his audience, because you write for an audience at, you know, at the end of the day, And his audience changed so massively between The Mirror and Politico that actually there is so much stuff now that, you know, had he been at The Mirror, it would have been like, that's quite funny, but that's complete gossip. The readers of The Mirror will not care at all. But now in Politico, he's like, you know, that's something that could be at the top of the email now because the audience is different. So there's really no straight line between what's gossip and what's news, I guess.
Do you remember the first time that you heard an example of Westminster Gossip and you thought, oh yeah, that is great. That's a great story, or however you want to characterise it.
So my first ever sort of like diary, like small exclusive, but exclusive nonetheless, was during the Labour leadership contest in 2015. And a friend of mine messaged me and was like, oh my God, you'll never guess what. Andy Byrne.
Is that genuinely how gossip begins?
So pretty much.
That's fantastic.
And he was like, you'll never guess what. Andy Burnham's campaign and Liz Kendall's campaign accidentally booked campaign HQs in the same building. And that's really funny. And, you know, and that was, you know, it's clearly not Watergate, but that was genuinely fun. It had not been anywhere else, so I could have properly got to run back to the editor and say, I've got a really fun story. So I think that's the first bit of gossip I kind of heard and got to put in the paper. I think in a darker way, if you can that, which I think counts as gossip, definitely like a few months before that, I think I started hearing like a few rumours about sort of like creepy basically men in Westminster, which is something that's addressed in the book as well, the kind of role of the Whisper Network and how gossip is not just kind of like fun, but it also can be used to basically keep people safe. So I heard a few, like, you know, MPX or Advisor Y, like, try not to kind of like be around them when they're drunk.
On that subject, this book comes out after a lot of the allegations about sexual impropriety and that sort of thing. Do you think you could have written this book prior to that coming out, or would it have been a very different sort of thing?
I think I could have written it before that. I don't know, because actually it was quite an interesting thing. So I did ask quite a lot of the people I interviewed about kind of like the Me Too scandal and kind of that side of gossip. And especially, I think, women really interesting to talk to, like women who've been in Westminster for quite a long time, because most of them said, well, you know, actually, until very recently, it's completely true that we didn't take it seriously. But even the women ourselves, that we didn't, you know, that's something we'd brush off quite easily. So, you know, that MP's quite a creep, like, you know, but that's like we'd treat that as a funny piece of gossip as opposed to now, where I think they'll be quite serious and maybe end up in the papers. So I think that has definitely changed. I think that kind of like type of gossip has kind of changed over the past, or like however long, so I think 2 years now or whatever. But I think I definitely would have mentioned it anyway, because it is something I find sort of like interesting and I think deserves to be talked about.
The book talks about the role of gossip in the machinery of Westminster. Can you see a time when things will be different in that respect, or has it always been this way and it will always be this way?
So not really. I don't think it'll change. And I kind of, so obviously the book is quite anchored in, you know, like the times we live in now. A lot of the anecdotes are quite recent, etc. But it's not quite meant as an analysis of purely kind of, you know, again, like the times we live in now. So the argument...
And nor is it a sort of tell-all book. It's not a book just listing interesting bits of gossip.
So I am a bit worried. I do think some people think it's basically a Guido column for 300 pages, which it's not. I've basically written quite a nerdy book, but made it sound exciting, which I'm quite happy about.
That was perfect combination as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I know, I think one of the main arguments is that basically gossip, well, there's a few different things. Like the first one I'd say is that gossip is completely part of the fabric of Westminster, and that, because it's not just about MPs, but you know, obviously like MPs, their stuff is ministers, spads, journalists, lobbyists, kind of like everyone, peers, like everyone in the Westminster bubble. I think every person in every job will need to kind of rely on gossip and informal conversations and whispers and unconfirmed facts in order to do their job properly. And I guess coming from that as well, I guess my kind of grand thesis is that informal information becomes crucial when formal channels are not working properly. So one of the main examples is like, I wrote quite a lot about civil servants, which was really interesting for me because I guess before writing the book, I didn't know as much about the civil service as I do about, you know, again, at Parliament or whatever. You know, and gossip is an important part of working at the civil service on Whitehall. And that is partly because the communications channels between the ministers and the civil servants are completely broken most of the time. So their private office will normally cut off, you know, kind of like put the minister in a cupboard at all times. And you can only like see he or she if you've got some like special kind of, you know, right, etc., etc. So actually the way a lot of civil servants work is by having to rely on the grapevine, rely on that and, you know, but to actually like actively be more effective at their job. So one example, one former civil servant had quite an interesting example. So they worked at the MOJ, I think, at the time, and said basically our minister was shit, but also we knew that the minister had a really terrible relationship with Number 10. And so basically all the reforms he wanted to get through, we didn't really do because we knew they were not going to happen. We knew he was on the way out. We knew, you know, there was no point in us doing it. And actually, as a civil servant, he was like, you know, it's our job to know which piece of legislation we have to focus on, which ones we know will never get anywhere. So again, so that's kind of, I think, an aspect of, you know, again, like gossip being used to actively, you know, not just for fun or for nefarious purposes, but actively so people can do their jobs properly.
Where do you think the line between gossips and leaks is drawn?
Ooh, that's a really interesting question.
Thank you very much. I do this for a living.
Oh, God, I do not like being on that side. I prefer asking the questions. God, I've got to think now. I think there's a lot of overlap. I would argue that a lot of leaks are also gossip, but not all of them, if that makes sense. So I think that, because I think gossip needs to be fundamentally interesting, not necessarily fun, I think, but, like, you know, interesting and quite titillating in order to be gossip. So I think that, you know, if there's a leak of obviously the minutes of a meeting or the, like, you know, WhatsApp group of an MP's WhatsApp group, which I think is a kind of like classic genre at the moment of leaks, then that definitely feels like gossip to me. But if it's something like, you know, bits of a white paper that's not come out quite yet, you know, because there's concerns from the regulator of that bit of the industry that, you know, there might have been lobbying on that white paper, that's not gossip. That's not very dull.
I think we can all agree that's not nearly as much fun as a dick pic.
Exactly. At the end of the day, what do we want? Yeah.
What do we want? Dick pics. When do we want them? Anyway.
So I do think that you need, I would argue that gossip needs to have a level of human interest. And so, yeah, so again, something else can be, you know, like a leak about, again, like a white paper or something like that is definitely interesting, but it's unclear to me where the kind of like properly human interest opposed to professional interest lies.
Presumably on your role as a diarist and as a journalist, you will have people trying to plant gossip with you, whether it's sort of standing next to you with a cleverly crafted quip or something like that. How do you deal with that?
So actually, weirdly, I'd say it's kind of the opposite. Well, I feel I got a lot more of that when I was a reporter. So when I was a BuzzFeed mostly, because that's kind of where I did most of my work as a political reporter, that's kind of when I would have people being, oh, by the way, you know, there's this, there's that. And actually, that's part of the reason why I didn't enjoy being a reporter is because, like, especially within politics, because I kind of felt like I was being used. Like, I kind of feel like, you know, I was in the middle of a war, like a massive sort of like brawl, and I was just used as a weapon by different people in different factions at all times. Like, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, better journalists than me struggle less with that than I did. But I think for me, it's always the problem of someone gives you a story and you have to consider on the one hand, you know, why they gave it to you and what they're trying to achieve with that. But on the other hand, how good the story is. Is it really in the public interest? Is it worth publishing, etc.? And I think I called it wrong a few times when I was at BuzzFeed on like very minor stuff, but that's not something I enjoyed at all. So in a weird way, I think, and that's why I have a lot of time for The Diary and I have a lot of time for Pop Bitch as well in places like then Private Eye, is that they're just doing, you know, it's mischief for mischief's sake. So they're just doing it to have fun. And actually, there's a quote, I think, from Patrick Kidd, who's the diary editor of The Times, and who says that, you know, he's on a number of occasions not printed diary stories because he was like, actually, there was just someone trying to, like, get one over someone else. And that's not what we're here for. Like, we're just here to, like, make people laugh and have a bit of fun.
Presumably, at the same time, there are stories that you can't publish for a host of reasons, but most obviously for legal reasons, because they're defamatory, they're libelous, et cetera, et cetera. How, when you were writing the book, did you decide about what to include and what not to include?
The thing about the book, and I think which I didn't think about before writing a book, if you're planning to write a book and you're listening, pay attention to this because no one had warned me about this. But what I really struggled with was my audience, my imagined audience, that, you know, who I imagined to be reading the book and their levels of kind of, you know, how much did they know about politics, how much they want to know, you know, how much they needed terms explained, et cetera, et cetera. And I was always very keen on writing a book about politics that was very accessible. So to people who are maybe like nerd adjacent is kind of the way I describe it. So who clearly have an interest, you know, they might watch Newsnight or whatever. But
they might
not
download this podcast, for instance.
Yes.
Just speculating.
Yes, no, exactly. But they're not, you know, the people sort of like glued to Twitter from morning to night, just, you know, watching the
everything. Well, actually, during the 79 campaign.
Yeah. You know, but so I think that was quite useful in a way, because then I realised that quite a lot of the anecdotes, obviously, you know, I wanted to put in, which would have been legally tricky, would have only been really, really fun, like, named, like, you know, more fun named for a very small minority of people, because they're mostly about, you know, random MPs most people will never have heard of, or like former special advisors who, again, like maybe 1,000 people know who they are. And so it's a bit like, okay, do I want to get into this massive like war, massive sort of like legal fight just so a few more people will be entertained? Or is it not the case that those anecdotes are just quite fun and quite revealing in their own way, even if you don't know the name of the person?
Yeah, so we will hear, for instance, that an MP had sex with a dead horse, but we don't need to know the name of the horse.
Exactly. That's precisely that. I didn't know you knew about the horse.
Oh, well, you know, if you've been in Westminster long enough, you know the name of the horse. Marie, you are a French, and as a result, you believe that that growing up in a different system, away from the very much the conveyor belt that a lot of people go through in Westminster of PPE at Oxford, researcher for an MP, think tank, etc., etc., do you think coming at this from a different angle has given you a alternative view of all of this in the book?
Ooh, yes and no. I think that I feel quite lucky with the kind of, I guess, yes, status I have of kind of, I always think I've got a bit of, you know, one foot in, one foot out. Or to use a beautiful poetic French phrase, my arse is stuck between two chairs.
What's that en français?
Le cul entre deux chaises.
Ah oui.
Yep, that's the one. But no, which I think is really good because I think I've kind of been in Westminster for long enough and I've got enough friends and kind of acquaintances in Westminster that I do feel like an insider, and if there's something I need to know or someone I'm trying to get in touch with, I can.
Yeah, and I think most people who know of you would describe you as a Westminster insider.
Again, because as you said, because I think I didn't grow up in it or anything, so it's kind of very much a choice I made at the end of the day not that long ago to be like, you know, I'm kind of going to try and become part of this universe. So I do think that it's easier for me to occasionally take a step back and say, you know, what the fuck is going on? What the fuck is this? Or, you know, there might be stuff that, because I think one of the topics that keeps coming back in the book is the closeness between journalists and politicians, which I think is a very complex topic, because I think it's all very easy. On the one hand, it's very easy to say, oh, well, you know, political journalists, of course, should never be friends with MPs. But actually, you know, good political journalism could not happen if those relationships didn't exist, if that trust didn't exist. But on the other hand, it is true that occasionally, you know, you see, because I can't remember who it was, but I think like a political editor who was the best man for the at the wedding of an MP, and that's one of those where instinctively you want to say, actually, hang on, that feels wrong, you know, that feels too far. So yeah, and it is kind of like a topic I'm really interested in, and I'm not sure, had I basically grown up, I think, in that kind of incubator, I'm not sure I would have spent that much time kind of thinking, like kind of obsessing slightly over the nature of those relationships and how they influence the work that each side does.
What would you change about the way information flows around Westminster in order to improve the situation?
So the conclusion of the book, spoilers, is largely that it would be quite hard to change the system. So I kind of try and look at ways, you know, I kind of go the entire other way for the conclusion. I'm like, okay, if you wanted to kind of stamp out the influence gossip plays in Westminster, what would you have to do? What measures could you implement to make sure that gossip becomes less important? And it just becomes evident really, really quickly that it is impossible. Like the rules you'd have to put in, the things you'd have to do are completely sort of like, on the one hand, are completely sort of like impossible. But on the other, I think that, you know, people in Westminster they're not clearly the most popular people in the country. And I'm not saying all of them are great, not at all. But the vast majority of them are paid less than they would be if they worked basically elsewhere, given their usual background and education. They work very long hours. For a lot of them, they can basically lose their job at the drop of a hat. So, you know, especially kind of like MPs and spads, etc. No, it's not always a pleasant job. Again, everyone hates you, and that's true for journalists and MPs.
And pollsters.
Exactly. And you've seen that recently as well, obviously, of like, you know, people barely seeing their kids or like, you know, not being able to go on holiday because they're so busy, etc. So if you've got all that already and then you're going to remove one of the few things that makes the job really quite fun and intellectually challenging, then who the fuck would want to get into politics or political journalism or anything? I think, you know, it is a human, I guess the grand sort of like message of the book is that people in Westminster are just that, they're just people. And actually wherever you end up putting a lot of people who are, you know, obviously like stressed and overworked and neurotic, etc., in the same place, then obviously kind of squishy human things are going to happen, because you can't strip people of their humanity just because you decide they're too important to just behave like people.
You have been accused of being a spy in the past. Are you a spy?
Well, no.
And but it's really isn't that what a spy would say?
No, honestly, I really want to be a spy. I have tweeted about this several times.
I don't think real spies tweet about how much they want to be spies.
Well, yeah, but no one's offered. I'm not sure.
No one? Not the French Secret Service or any other?
No.
Not even Mossad?
No.
Oh God, we've all been tapped up by Mossad.
I feel really cross. I feel really left out. I do. Again, I maintain I'd make a great spy. So yeah, if you're listening, spies, please get in touch.
I think the first time I ever met you, you were wearing a hat much like a spy would wear.
See, no, I'm good at wearing hats. I speak several languages. I like meeting people. I like secrets. It's very obvious that I should never be a spy, so great bluff.
You've got a good accent and you enjoy sitting on park benches for hours at a time.
You know what? Sometimes when I have time between two meetings in Westminster, I just go sit in St. James's Park and I read a book.
Like, does anyone sit next to you and say,
no,
the weather is warm in Morocco at this time of year?
Every time, I hope.
Every time you turn around and say, no, no, it's not. No.
Yeah, well, they let some fucking like creepy man is going to try and sit next to me now. But oh my God, finally.
Yes. If someone contacts you on Tinder claiming to be a recruiter for MI6, it's probably best to check them out first. You know, unless they're hot. Mm. And since this is, of course, our podcast, as many of our listeners will remember, give us an exclusive piece of gossip.
So, no, but I can give you one funny story instead.
Oh, yeah, we'll go for that.
Fine. But next, again, as I said, you know, most of the gossip in the book is either stuff that's... It's basically either stuff that's named but has maybe been in the papers, but unless you're a huge nerd, you wouldn't have heard of it. You know, or just random stuff that has been in the papers, but I thought was really funny, so I wanted an excuse to put it back. So my favourite is... So I was trying to... In one of the chapters, I kind of tried to explain how public interest works and how tabloids especially can play around with this. If there's something they really want to publish, they can always play around the notion of public interest.
So it's always the distinction between of interest to the public and public interest.
But so I think my all-time favourite of that case, especially in politics, was so a few years ago, Simon Danchuk was banging this woman who I want to say was 19, I can't remember. Anyway, and the Sunday
separate
was a big
from
on
his
it.
Wife Karen.
And so that was the entire thing. So if you look at the story more carefully, Simon Danchuk was divorced by that point, separated from his partner. So he was a single man. The woman was not underage. It was entirely consensual. Like that was just, you know, in what world is that a public interest story? But, my friend, they apparently once had sex in his constituency office, paid for by the taxpayers who deserve to know what happens with their money. And that was just so great. And I just loved that so much because then they got in touch with the girl who leaked them the texts of their affair. And no, so remember, it was 2016 because it was just before the referendum. And this poor girl, so like texted Simon at some point and was like, oh, Simon, like, by the way, you're an MP, like, you know, what's gonna happen to Eurovision if Leave wins? And he replied, I'm going to fuck you so hard, you're going to forget about the fucking Eurovision.
Wow. That's a strong opening line.
I think it's like four exclamation marks.
It's up there with you up and down to fuck.
It's just, and that made me laugh so much. But anyway, so there's a lot of that. But no, so one story which is very mundane, but I thought was quite fun, which came from Theo Bertram, the former Labour advisor, and which I think is kind of like quite telling as well about the way Westminster works and just how neurotic everyone is. So when he was quite a junior staffer at Labour HQ, but he was like, you know, like properly the kind of like lowest of the low, like super junior, him and his friends started, so obviously Labour was in government, started a spad list, which was meant to be, you know, sort of like half serious, half fun. Like one afternoon they were bored, which was kind of like, so obviously all the names of the spads and then categories like, do they reply to our phone calls when we call? Do they buy the round? Do they buy their round when we're in the pub knowing that they're all better paid than us? You know, so like lots of like small things like that. And, you know, so they kind of like rang the spads on the spad list. And then eventually the spads caught wind of it and we see madness ensued. So again, it was all like these random junior Labour HQ people and you'd have these senior spads being like, can I know where I am on the list? Or like, if I tell you X about, you know, that other spad, like, can they go down? And so, yeah, all the spads were kind of circling like vultures around that random desk of like education, you know, whatever Labour HQ researchers. And yeah, so they had to stop doing the spad rankings because it just got totally out of hand.
I'm sure many people listening to this will now be extremely interested to know where this book can be purchased. So apart from all good Amazons, where can we turn to if we have to buy our own copies because our friends haven't sent us one?
I don't know. I'm not your mum. Bookshops, I guess.
Marie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know. Even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podotpods.com.